Coming up on Boston Public Radio, if cancer was cured, Wacko Hurley relented, and gun reform passed, you'd never know it if you watch cable TV. It's all Malaysia 370 all the time. We'll ask you if they're simply giving viewers, meaning us, what we want. Then Globe editor Brian McGrory on the same subject, the St. Patrick's Day breakfast, and his Menino exclusive. And speaking of the mayor, medical ethicist Art Kaplan will talk about his cancer and the obligation of public officials and electoral wannabes to disclose their health histories.
We'll preview an astounding frontline documentary on the second deadliest infectious disease on Earth. Then, the evidence is in. Teens who start school much later do better on every academic measure. So isn't it time to let the exhausted kids get an extra hour of sleep? We'll debate it up next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So Marjorie and I can't decide if we've been irresponsible in our news coverage or not. We'll let you be the judge, but in the last 12 days, you may have noticed, we have not talked about this.
Could it have reached land? And if so, where?
The plane may have disintegrated in midair.
It's possible it was hijacked and forced to land at another airport.
These three objects have been found. Is it the plane?
Two switches were pulled in that cockpit.
Were pulled. That suggests deliberate.
Deliberate.
Devil's Triangle, the Pacific Ocean's version of the Bermuda Triangle,
just disappeared in a Bermuda Triangle on its way to Beijing. Did Flight 370 actually even take off?
Extraterrestrial or extra-dimensional race to take the whole craft, to not put it back, that's the baffling part.
Aliens. Maybe an alien came down and just ate it.
You know, the missing Malaysian jet, you know this, has dwarfed everything. Chris Christie is probably happy about it. Syrians, though, are in the throes of a civil war, might not be. Yes, the missing aircraft gets the CIA off the hook for a few days. But what about developments in Ukraine, for example? Do we even know what the situation is there? But let me be clear up front. We surely are not minimizing the fact that 239 people in the aircraft could very well be dead. But the coverage is unrelenting. So if you think it's too much, or you say you think it's too much, who's at fault? Them, meaning the media, I guess us, or are they simply giving you, me, and Marjorie exactly what we want? Our number is 877-301-8970, and we are finally, I guess this is day 12, I believe it is, of the missing Malaysian jet flight 370.
You know, we should point out, too, that Americans are hardly unique in this. You've mentioned CNN's coverage has gone absolutely through the roof since they've been covering it virtually nonstop.
And their ratings have doubled, by the way.
Absolutely. The ratings have doubled. But the BBC, their website, the 17 of the top of the 20 top stories were all about the airplane. In Germany, the tabloids over there are playing this big time. In China, of course, that's because so many of the families are from China, so they're particularly tragically interested. Twitter messages about the plane, they peaked at nearly 1 million per day shortly after it went missing. And, you know, the Twitterverse has maintained its intense interest in France. So this is a kind of a worldwide kind of thing. And it's a tough one because people are totally transfixed by this, not just the mystery of it and the tragedy of it, because everybody or most everybody takes airplanes and everybody can imagine they can relate to this.
Can I differ with one thing you said? The vast majority of people, I don't mean this harshly, I mean it honestly, are not transfixed because of the tragedy of 239 families losing somebody they love. Everybody who covers this does the mandatory, if they can, interview with a family member, talks. But this is all about the mystery of this. That really, it is one of the great mysteries of our time. There was a great piece, the Globe has a front page Metro story today, talking about the local obsession with this. And there's a quote from somebody, I'm sorry I didn't write down his or her name, but one of the reasons, I thought this was very insightful by this person. This person said one of the reasons they're obsessed with it, and everybody apparently is that everybody's opinion is equally valid. You can't Google the answer on this one. Everybody can speculate equally. Everybody can quote what they saw in the cockpit simulator on CNN last night. And so we want to know which camp you're in. 877-301-8970. Is the news media the problem, or in the spirit of Pogo, is the enemy us? Are they simply giving us exactly what we want. And by the way, the ratings at CNN would suggest it's the latter answer. The numbers have literally gone up 100%.
877-301-8970 is our phone number. BPR at WGBHnews.org is the email if you want to email in. You know, I think one of the things you can criticize a little bit here, or a lot if you care to, is sort of what we heard in our montage coming in, you know, that aliens have picked up the plane and carried it off to some far out galaxy. I mean, that seems a little crazy to hear about on a news station.
It's a little crazy, yeah.
Or the Devil's Triangle, you know, it's the Bermuda Triangle part two. I mean, I know a lot of people believe in the Bermuda Triangle, but it seems to be this is a different ocean for the Bermuda Triangle. Don Lemon on CNN, he was talking about possible supernatural forces that may have, again, absconded with this airplane. So there seems to be kind of, and then what was weird, because I admit I had been watching it too. They had this guy on CNN, a pilot, that came on and talked about just last night. He said, "Well, we think that there may have been a fire in the cockpit, and this caused the pilots to do weird things." And then within 10 minutes, they had somebody else come on and say that was totally ridiculous. There was never couldn't be a fire in the pilot. So it's like these dueling experts, one calling the last expert ridiculous, and then, you know, one of the anchor people holding a little plane in their hand or sitting in the simulator, you know, rehashing news that really isn't news because they speculated about it already for 4 days.
Of course it's news. It's breaking news that there is no breaking news. Now, let me just say in defense of these anchors, particularly at CNN, but it's CNN is at the top of the pack. And again, they're reaping the greatest rewards.
I gave the wrong email address.
What is it?
It's BPR at WGBH.org.
Fine.
Thank you, Chelsea.
Let me come to the defense of the anchors. As someone who does interviews every single night on NEC, you know what the greatest nightmare is ever? When the producer says in your ear, can you stretch it for two more minutes? The next guest is not there. These anchors, with some exceptions, are smart enough to know there's not enough material to be talking and bringing up new and newsworthy things 24/7. But again, everybody is watching, so it's hard to be a little tough on the media when the audience is there.
Well, you know something? Everybody talks about what everybody's talking about around the water cooler at the barbershop. Yesterday I was getting my hair cut. What was everybody
Looks
talking
good,
about?
Way.
Thank you very much. What was everybody talking about at the haircut place? The airplane. We were all sitting there. You know, Anne, who cuts my hair, was saying Tintillations, actually. She's over in Newton.
Nicely done.
She was saying how
I think
the
you
plane,
violated federal law
the
right
plane
there,
landed on some island out there. And I thought, well, Anne, how can it land on an island? Because it's a big, huge plane. She said, no, the runways are long enough. So her theory is that it's landed on some island somewhere. Then some other person thinks that, and this is a big common theory.
What's this one?
Well, it was terrorists took the airplane. And the reason the terrorists took it was to tragically do dastardly things to the passengers so that have an airplane for a future kind of 9/11 sort of thing. That's another big theory that's floating around. But the question is, where is this airplane hiding if it's still out there above ground?
877-301-8970. So again, we wanted to give you a chance, since we haven't talked about this at all over the last 12 days, want to give you a chance to find out whether you think the media has been responsible here, if you think they have been irresponsible in the breadth of their coverage. We want to know if you think they're the problem or you're the problem. And I have to admit, since I'm sure you're going to ask me in 2 seconds, last night I spent about 11 hours in front of the TV watching.
You
see, it was hard to even go to sleep.
That to
no,
me.
It is. And by the way,
earlier
you know,
this morning when you were ranting and raving about the disgracefulness of all this coverage, then you told me you spent 4 hours watching it yourself.
No, it is really hard. And you know what you do, which is even, I don't know if hypocritical is the right word, more perverse, is as you watch unendingly, you complain unendingly about people who are watching, and then you're just totally transfixed. 877-301-8970. It's your turn. Are you watching? And if you are, what draws you there? And if you're not, who do you think is the problem?
One thing before we get to the calls. We have CNN on in the studio here.
Best graphics, by the way. And they're incredible.
They began at noontime, and they have continued. We have an airplane now superimposed, and the anchor person seems to be standing on some disc that's flying through the air.
He does explanations.
Yeah.
And they're actually fairly interesting, by the way.
Listen,
but
I love CNN. It's my favorite station.
And can I tell you, when I watch him do an explanation, by the 15th or 16th time he's done it, I begin to understand what he's talking about. Let's go to Steve. He's on the road. He is first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Steve.
Oh, thanks, Jim and Marjorie. I actually think the media is doing this is a legitimate service that they're providing, and I say that because I think it's a reflection of a feeling of uncertainty about the world situation. You've got the Ukraine, you've got Syria, I think you guys mentioned the backdrop of terrorism. There's just a feeling, I think, of sort of uncertainty about the world. And this little episode, and granted in the grand sweep of things, is fairly insignificant, I think kind of captures that feeling of uneasiness that people have about the world situation today.
You know, that is a fantastic point, because I think that's what you hear people saying. How can this happen that, you know, we can find these pings from cell phones like thousands of miles away and this big, huge jet liner can just disappear? I mean, that is a great point.
Right. And if I could add, I also think there's a kind of level of uncertainty about, and this may be a bit of a stretch, but the United States no longer seems to be the power it once was. And, you know, when you've got the president sort of sitting down between two ferns with Zach Galifianakis or whatever his name is, you know, in the midst of all this sort of international chaos, again, it just fuels this feeling of uncertainty.
Well, power. I have to say, I am a defender of the president on that one, meaning if you want to communicate to young people about the need for them to sign up for the Affordable Care Act, that's why he was doing it. He wasn't doing it to lower the prestige. However, if you want to talk about prestige, I would argue that when Joe Biden is in Poland and the president of the United States is issuing sanction after sanction against Russia and the leaders in Russia, and Putin and his deputies all laugh at the United States, you have serious question as to what influence we have beyond our borders. But Steve, thanks for your insight. We really appreciate it. 877-301-8970. It is amazing how all stories get drowned out. It really is. And you know, I was trying to think, can you think of something other than things obviously that are huge, that have huge direct impact on people? Obviously, 9/11 is the most extreme example of that. I can't think of a situation like this. You said to us right before we went on the air, when you talk about weather, which by the way, the highest ratings on my station, NECN, when there's a dramatic or violent weather episode. But you made the point, which I think is a good one, upstairs or in the newsroom, to me, that you're much more interested in weather when it's nearby.
Exactly.
And this is not nearby. And while you could argue, I mean, one of our colleagues, we won't name who it is because I don't know if he wants us to mention it, his wife is flying overseas today, and he said she was quite nervous as a result of this Malaysia Flight 370 thing. So I guess you could argue that's the connection to us, but it's a much more a tentative connection than there is when there's bad weather in New England.
Well, the Pew Research Center, and we love the Pew Research Center, although the only thing I doubt them about is whether people who listen to scandals involving celebrities nonstop or read about it would admit it to the Pew Research Center. But except for that, they talk about the things that people are most interested in and the news that they pay attention most to, and war and terrorism.
Or what they say they are, you said?
They say they do, war and terrorism. But that rings true. I mean, particularly if, although we have not been as riveted by our own wars in Iraq.
Well, I was just going to say, by the way, terrorism, yes, I think our interest in wars is painfully modest, considering when our neighbors are worrying about whether their sons, daughters, husbands, and wives are going to wake up alive the next day.
Well, that's what they say. They say it's war and terrorism, bad weather, natural and man-made disaster, although that has a lot to do with where the man-made disaster is.
Yeah.
We're much more interested in Hurricane Sandy than we might be in the wildfires in California because they're far away from us. Money is something we're quite interested in, and crime, health, and politics. Although I would argue that people aren't that interested in politics anymore.
How about celebrity news?
Well, people say they have no interest in celebrity news, but
they're lying.
You know, well, the National Enquirer is huge circulation at a time when newspapers are really struggling, and websites like BuzzFeed that deal with celebrities are huge. So I think if you're spending all your time worrying about what Lindsay Lohan is doing, you probably don't want to admit it to a person from the Pew Research Center. You know what
Maybe
I mean?
Maybe you don't. 877-301-8970. We're finally talking about at least the public's interest and the insatiable interest and the much of the media's willingness to satisfy that interest over Flight 370. Let's go to the south coast of Massachusetts, where Dave is on the phone. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Sidebar, the weather on the nightly news has the most impact on your life.
It's true.
That's right.
So that's people, and they give it the least amount of time.
Okay. Gee, you think so? I think they give it a lot of time. Oh, you talking about the nightly national news or the local
I'm
news?
I'm talking about Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 7.
We do a lot of weather on NECN. Let me be clear right there, but go ahead.
I like the guy, your morning guy, if he's still doing it. And like you said, when
Matt Noyes, genius. Yeah, go ahead.
Matt, yes. Now, in turn, going back to the issue at hand, I think that the NPR-based stations, your station, BUR, have been very, very flat level, not sensational, trying to keep up with it. Some very good panel discussions, Diane Rehm, Tom Ashcroft. There's a whole bunch of things,
Brooke,
where you've been able to get facts. I could remember listening to a guy talking about it on Tom Ashcroft's show,
Brooke,
when they hadn't even, you know, this was like two or three days in, and things that he was talking about as a remote possibility seemed to have become the thing, i.e. somebody's played with the controls and they went someplace else.
Yeah, but can I tell you, Dave, if I can interrupt you, the place where I am lost, even though I cannot tell a lie, I keep watching anyway, when facts are being reported and we're being educated about how jets and radar and all those kinds of things work, I find that very interesting. But when most of an evening's coverage is totally irresponsible speculation, as evidenced by, as Marjorie said a minute ago, 1 minute they say it's X, and the next minute another expert comes on and says it couldn't possibly be X. When that's essentially the centerpiece of the coverage, because there is no news, that's the point at which you start saying they've gone over the line, don't you think?
Well, I listened to, I was reading this morning somewhere, probably NPR, but I'm not sure. People's complaint about it's 12 days and they haven't found the plane yet.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, if you look at a map, a globe of the world, 70% of it's water.
Yeah.
And most of that is south of the equator.
Yeah,
no, we hear you.
They've got a huge space to look for it. And that Air France plane that went that crashed in 2009, it took them a month to find that. Remember that? It was a big ocean storm in the Atlantic. It took them a whole month. Emily had a great on Greater Boston had a great piece on that. 2 years later, they were picking the pieces of the plane out of the water. Our number is 877-301-8970. We're debating whether this nonstop coverage is excessive or whether it's okay, because we can obviously relate to this. Because everybody flies in airplanes, and because this is a mystery. And as the first caller said, I think it was great that it just plays into this kind of sense of uncertainty that we all feel with everything else seeming to go, or not everything else, but many things seem to go awry in the world. What do you think? 877-301-8970. Margaret from Burlington. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
For me, it's not a matter of too much coverage, too little. For me, it's a matter more of how accurate is it. As a citizen of the United States, I and my husband, we travel all over the world. How safe is it for myself, for my children, for our friends, family, to get on a plane nowadays and travel, if you will, to Malaysia or to go to China? So I listen because I'm trying to understand and I care about what's happening in these poor people and families, but I want to understand and think for myself and figure out what's happening here. Should we be traveling?
Yeah, but Margaret, and while I think that's a totally legitimate concern and one I share, if it is for you the primary concern, then wouldn't you wait till they find out what actually happened? How does it help advance your knowledge when essentially we admit every night all we do is we engage in hours of speculation. And if one piece of speculation is right, then you have reason to be concerned. And if it's wrong, you have no reason to be concerned. So how does it advance your sense of personal safety?
Okay, well, I think most of us realize at times when things are speculative, where things are really quite stupid and silly, if I may be honest about
it.
And I think it's my responsibility. I'm a thinking
good
human
for you.
Being,
okay, I got it.
And I can kind of decipher for myself, come on, what's going on here?
Got it. It's a good point. Margaret, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
You know what's another thing that's upsetting about this, too? All this focus on the pilots. And we have no idea if the pilots did anything wrong. But we've talked about this before. Remember that great book, Tom Wolfe, The Right Stuff, became a movie.
Movie too.
And if you haven't read that book, it's a terrific book. And it has this whole section there when he talks about
how, the astronauts.
Well, about pilots on airplanes. How you're in an airplane and the thing is shaking around all over the place. And all of a sudden this voice comes on from this pilot. And he looks like John Wayne. And he's broad-shouldered and 6'2", and he's got a slight southern drawl that gets on the speaker. Don't worry, ladies and gentlemen. I can't imitate.
I know exactly what you mean.
Just a little turbulence here. No need to worry. And he sounds calm and reassuring. When you get on an airplane, it's very comforting to see the pilot looking in charge and like the right stuff kind of guy. And to think that there may have been, and we don't know yet, but people keep bringing this up, that other pilots have done this. It's rare, but they've done this before, you know, committed suicide mm-hmm. with their airplane. That's really disconcerting, too, because you think...
Unless they didn't.
Unless they didn't, and we don't know. But the undermining the confidence in the pilot thing. Did you know about these suicides before?
Well, actually, I didn't until a couple of days
exactly.
ago. I started doing research off this.
So you say to yourself, huh, do I have to worry about the pilot now? You know, in addition to everything else.
At the same time, you realize we've engaged in almost two full weeks of slander.
Against
of two
the
men who may have, something horrible may have happened, catastrophic on the plane. There may have been a hijacking. There may have been some sort of terrorism. But essentially, these guys, their reputations
besmirched. Absolutely stellar. You saw the guy in his house, the video of the elder pilot, the chief pilot, the co-pilot was a much younger young man, 27 years old, the elder guy, looking like, you know, a right stuff kind of guy, talking about his fascination, the simulator in his house, et cetera. So, but again, it just makes you nervous. 877-301-8970.
Alan in Leominster, you're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thanks for the call, Alan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I think this thing is so overplayed for all the reasons that you gave in terms of not knowing. Tell me when you have something new. I feel very badly for all the people on the plane and for all their relatives, but... jumping around, not knowing whether you're coming or going, isn't going to help anyone. On top of which, I take a look at what Putin is doing. Does anyone care that he's taken over a piece of a sovereign country and is on the borders of other sovereign countries? That, to me, where it affects millions and millions and millions of people... that, to me, should be overplayed on.
Okay, Alan, do you read the thing? Marjorie and I both read these things incessantly. Every single newspaper has usually on the right-hand side of their homepage what the most viewed and emailed stories are. And by the way, I could not agree with you more. However, would you not agree that if there were 10 stories, 9 of which were about Flight 370 and one of which was about the annexation of Crimea, that the 9 stories with speculation about the flight would be 1 through 9 and Crimea would be 10. You'd agree, would you not?
Yes, because the media has played it up. I mean, that's all you see on TV. As you said, on CNN, that's all you see.
Well, we don't want to just blame CNN. This is this is going to become a copycat thing, too, because they've been so wildly successful. But again, I think that's where the pogo thing comes in. We are far less interested. I'm sure the people in Crimea, even before 3 weeks ago, knew much more about us than we know about them, because the vast majority of Americans are not interested in what happens anywhere else in the world, no matter how serious the consequences are. This, though, is almost like, again, were it not for 239 missing individuals, it's almost like a made-for-television movie. Alan, thanks
for
the call.
But the other thing, the media is a business. I mean, they're in business to make money, and you don't make any money if no one is buying your newspaper or watching your station or listening to your radio broadcast. So that's the dilemma.
Yeah, but it's a dilemma, but it's one of the things we'll talk to Brian McGorry about in a couple of minutes. But there is a balance one has to find. If that were not the case, despite that Pew Center poll, you'd have all Kardashian news on the front page of the paper every
day. People say they don't care about the Kardashians.
I know, but they're
lying. That's what they claim.
Essentially.
Well, okay, there was a balance. I was watching this yesterday, and Wolf Blitzer apologized when he broke away briefly to show a picture of Vladimir Putin announcing he was annexing Crimea, and then went right back to the airplane.
No, he didn't.
He did.
Okay, let's go take a couple of more quick ones. Bob, you're in Arlington. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Bob.
Hey, how are you guys today?
Excellent, thank you.
Oh, good. Before I give my opinion on the coverage, which, you know, first of all, I mean, like, it's got to be covered. But can I give you a quick idea of where I think the plane might be?
Why not?
Okay. I think it's on Fantasy Island, and tattoos pointing up going, Buff, the plane!
Can I tell you something,
plane!
Bob? Now that you said that, I guarantee you thousands are going to be spreading that as the factual outcome of this thing. But what's your sense of the coverage, Bob?
Okay, first of all, you have to have this coverage.
Oh, I mean, well, some coverage, sure you do.
Yeah, but if you're not having more than the next network, you're not having enough. I mean, you know more about it than I do, both you and Marjorie. You're both in the business.
Yeah.
But if I'm watching, if I'm really that interested in it, who am I going to go to? the one that's got the most coverage.
Well, that's the point that Marjorie was making a minute ago. I mean, the eyes are telling the whole story. They're responding to a public demand. And on that count, people can criticize places like CNN all they want. Here is the headline, as we speak, is Wailing Mother Dragged from Briefing. You know, if it were not fact that she's obviously the mother of one of the 239 people, you'd say, come on already. Because, by the way, how many of these briefings have we seen where the aggrieved, heartbroken family members are screaming at Malaysian officials, airline companies?
It's horrible.
Bob, thanks.
And there have been so many of these Chinese parents that have one child because of the one child rule.
Well, can you imagine,
and they've lost their one child.
Or you don't even know. And you know what's even worse, by the way?
Let's be realistic here, Jim.
No, but can I tell you, and that's one of the dangers of the coverage. And I don't suggest that news coverage should be tailored to victims and their families. I understand that. However, when you're convinced you lost somebody you love, and then you watch an hour of television at night and you hear people with credentials at the bottom of the screen say, well, I think it landed on an island undercover. It's in a hangar. It's under trees. What do you then say to yourself? Maybe my husband or daughter is alive. And I mean,
it's possible they are, but it's not looking very good, you would say, at this stage. Again, it's missing since March 8th. We have a mixed email. Most everyone is saying, actually, it's mixed. Most people are saying that there's been a lot of coverage, but it's because of the mystery, because of the unknown quality to this, because there's more than 200 people missing. It's worth it. Stephen makes a morbid black humor joke and says the flight left Malaysian airspace and then the tower transferred control to DCF. He, of course, is referring to the Department of Children and Families in Massachusetts.
Well, a lot of people think that's
lost many children underneath its care, care, I should say.
One last one. Jeff, you're in Taunton. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I think it's a case where reality did meet fiction. This could be an episode from Lost.
Absolutely.
And I think what's really driving the coverage is just human nature. I think humans don't like two things. Well, they're attracted to mysteries, but they actually want them solved. And I think that is really the hold, and the media is giving the coverage that humans want.
I think that last sentence is totally true. So, Jeff, how long does this go on, assuming the worst-case scenario, and it's weeks, if not months, till there's some closure, one of my least favorite words, but closure to this? Do we keep watching every night?
I think it could be years, and the reason I think that is Nova repeated an episode from 2011 on Air France, and they found parts of that airplane, they never found the flight recorders, data recorders. So I think it could go on for years. It'll taper off, the story will not have legs, so to speak, but it's going to be an unsolved mystery for years, probably. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
What will happen if the plane is not found? So there will be some other story with this kind of, and it's a bad phrase, but it's true in the news business, sexiness, that will attract the tremendous attention and that will take away from the aircraft. And then when there's a lull, as the caller just said, we'll be back on it. Anyway, up next, we are going to talk with Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy. Will get his take on the missing jet coverage. That and his thoughts on something he would like to see disappear, which is the St. Patrick's Day breakfast. Stay tuned for Brian McGroy up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Edgar B. Herwick III here from the WGBH Curiosity Desk. Now, we've all heard that sea levels are rising, but scientists say that here in Boston, they're rising 4 times faster than the global average. So what does that mean for us? Join me and some of the region's top scientists right here at WGBH on March 28th for a live panel discussion about climate change here in New England, part of WGBH's Smart Conversations series. Limited tickets are available at wgbh.org/events.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Worcester Art Museum, celebrating the opening of Knights with an evening of medieval revelry on March 28th and a Renaissance fair with music, jugglers, costumed performers, and more, March 29th and 30th. WorcesterArt.org. And Pop Money, available at Citizens Bank, a service where users can send, request, and receive money with an email address or smartphone. Information at popmoney.com or citizensbank.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. He joins us every Wednesday at about this time or at whatever time. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. Hey there, Brian McGorry.
Hello there, Jim Browdy. Hello there, Marjorie. How are you?
Good morning, Brian. Very well, thank you. You know, Brian, we just finished talking about this terrible, tragic Malaysia jetliner that is still missing after all these days. And CNN's taken some heat because they've been running it nonstop, and yet their ratings are through the roof, so people are obviously transfixed by it. I wonder how you decide. You guys had a Metro story today, kind of localizing it, talking about people, talking about this airline crash and all these bars all around Boston, Victoria Diner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you decide that, you know, as an editor? How do you decide balancing what's really, like, crucial, like maybe Crimea, with what people are really transfixed by, which clearly is this airline disaster?
Well, I mean, look, first of all, it is an important story. A huge 777 disappears seemingly into thin air, or into an ocean, or into land. 260-something people missing. That's the number, isn't it?
239.
And it's an important story, but it's also, as you point out, Marjorie, it's transfixed the public.
Yeah.
It's utterly fascinating. And, you know, in that vein, it's one of the great mysteries of this age. And so we are being a little bit liberal about how we play it. You know, today we had a story on the cover of the Metro front. Monday we had a story on the front page. Last week we had it on the front page a couple of times. You know, it's both interesting and important, so it's not really a close call. It's not. This isn't one of the Kardashian sisters doing something. This is a real news story. So I feel good about playing this story.
But well, let me be a little crasser. How do you balance? Well, you can even step back from the story if you want. How do you balance in your job what you think the public needs and what it wants? For example, I would assume, and you could determine this based upon your new digital skills, that probably 100 times more people are going to click on the fate of missing Malaysia jet rivets Boston front page Metro than on the Crimea story, even though I think in the grand scheme of things, the Crimea story that you have on page one is about 100 times more important to our lives and our futures. How do you make that determination?
Well, it's a good question, Jim, and it's not that difficult a determination to make. On the Crimea story, we sent our former Russian correspondent, former Moscow correspondent, David Filipov, to Ukraine to cover it day to day. He's been on the front page 4 days running now. We had a strong Boston angle in a story in the Sunday paper, and he's been covering the referendum and the aftermath, Putin moving in, Putin declaring that the peninsula is his. In the days after, if I, you know, had my way and he had a visa, I would get him into Moscow now to cover the surge of Russian nationalism. But we can do it both. We can do it all. It's not, you know, in terms of balance, we're not making the decision one or the other. We're not CNN where it's all jet all the time. We understand we have a pretty sophisticated audience here, that Crimea is a really, really important story for, and probably one for a long time to come. So we can serve both audiences.
You know, a couple of minutes ago, I made a big mistake and admitted that I spent 2.5 hours watching CNN last night talk about breaking news, that there was no breaking news. Are you watching any of this stuff or you're not? Tell the truth.
What do you want me to say? I am not. I'm not.
Okay.
I'm reading. But, you know, did you read the Andy Borowitz take in the New Yorker, in which the head of CNN issued a solemn public apology for breaking away from the Malaysian jetliner for about 2 minutes one day.
The Crimea, for the fact that they had voted to separate from Ukraine. Yeah, it was Jeff Zucker from CNN who allegedly, it was brilliant.
BorowitzReport.com. He vowed he would never do a mistake again.
You know, I happened to be watching yesterday, just as Wolf Blitzer had to do that in the Situation Room, had to almost apologize for doing exactly that yesterday. So it was almost art imitating life in the case of Borowitz.
But let's be honest here. There's no need for embarrassment about fascination with the Malaysian jet. There's no need for it. It is a gripping story. How does a jet like this, in this day and age of satellites and transponders and all else, how does it blip into thin air? I'm not embarrassed about being really interested in that.
And everyone can relate. I mean, everybody's, you know, on an airplane, significant portions of their life. You know something, though,
By the way, I'm having a viewing party tonight. If you're free, if you just Okay, for yeah, I'm sure you're busy.
Jim's going to wear his little aluminum foil hat.
Go ahead,
you know what you could do? You could serve little meals on those airline compartment trays.
Oh, that is totally that's inappropriate.
But you know what?
Completely insensitive, and I apologize for that.
But one thing we have done, Brian, you've been around for a while. I've been around for a while in the newspaper business. I know there was a move away. When I first started, we were obsessively covering politics. You know, huge city hall bureaus, huge state house bureaus, huge Washington bureaus. We'd sit up there at these meetings all day long. And there was a decision, I don't remember when it was, but somewhere along the line, that readers were not that interested in the so-called process stuff anymore. And I get that. And yet I feel as though we don't cover it. And part of it's manpower, but part of it, I think, is a philosophical decision, that moving away from that, you know, the meat and potatoes of politics.
Yeah, I agree with that somewhat, Marjorie. But as I look at the front page of today's Globe, we had the decision to have a story about Charlie Baker edging out his Republican rival, or trying to edge out his Republican rival in the Republican convention coming up.
Yeah.
So we do some of that. Yeah, I admit we do a lot less of it than we used to. But look, we still have a State House Bureau with several really, really good reporters up there. We still have a City Hall Bureau with a couple of really strong reporters here. We dedicated a ton of ink and digital space to the mayoral race. We will do it to the Scott Brown, Gene Shaheen race. We will do it to the governor's race. I happen to think people are a little busier these days and aren't as obsessive over the process of how we elect these candidates, but they still are interested in you know, who they are and how they get elected. So we've cut back to some extent, but I don't know. These aren't either-or decisions. We have a big, strong staff over here that we can cover multiple things, and you know, we try to strike the right balance.
Also, let me just say that in defense of coverage from both places, which I think is good, is there's far less process on Beacon Hill to cover. It's far more a function of what the Speaker and Senate President decide, and there aren't these rebellious, going rogue kinds of members. In any case,
you know,
Brian,
what's happened before I move on from Scott Brown and Gene Shaheen, you know what's happened, Brian McGroy, is that the texts from Senator Brown are starting to reemerge here in Jim's
cell phone. Maybe they are,
maybe
they aren't. Okay, fine.
Oh, tell me, is that really seriously?
I'm sorry.
Stop right there.
It's off the record.
Ear to ear.
Is this really
sources.
True?
The bromance is reignited.
Can you picture the look on Jim's face the first time the name Scott Brown appears on his phone with a text message? Just
okay, let's
beaming
move on.
From ear to ear.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Brian, for mentioning that. Now, Brian, as I do, I try to do every week, I try to read an excerpt from one of your fine columns from your earlier career.
Why do you do this?
Well, this is good, actually.
We go 1 week without it.
Here is the Boston Globe on Sunday after the St. Patrick's Day breakfast. Linda Dorsina-Forty rescues breakfast. That was Adrian Walker. Your actual story, I can't remember who wrote it, new host Dorsina-Forty spices storied breakfast. Let's go back to yesteryear. Here is Brian McGrory, No Breakfast of Champions. I'm begging anyone in South Boston with any sense, anyone on Beacon Hill who might hold sway for the sake of the city in the name of self-preservation, put an end to the annual St. Patrick's Day breakfast. It's a tradition that has woefully outlived its time, and here's one of Brian's lines of the century. Schindler's List was funnier than this year's affair. So were you right in 2006, or were Adrian Walker and I think Michael Levinson, I'm not sure, right in 2014?
Yeah, Michael Levinson and Josh Miller.
Who's right?
Oh, obviously I was. but let's just promise me something. When you read from my old column, give me a little more inflection, would you? I mean, you tamp it down and make it sound dull. But look, even this year's breakfast, in terms of the quality of humor, was god-awful. I mean, did you... It was
awful.
Terrible.
Did you almost say, did I watch it?
Yeah, I
hosted the television coverage.
Did
I watch it?
So they relied, as you well know, Jim, on these filmed skits that were painful. Like,
couple actually were very funny. The one,
no.
Oh, yes, I'm
Which
sorry.
One?
The first one when Linehan, the city council president, is allegedly in the back of a cab, and Linda Dorsina-Forty leans into the cab driver, and then I assume speaking Creole, says, "Take him far, far away." That was a funny bit, no?
Your bar for humor is so low you could trip on it.
Okay,
you know, or you couldn't trip on it. But we all love Warren Tolman, great guy. That skit with
awful.
Him reading from the book by the fireplace was painful.
Went on forever.
The Tom Menino, Deval Patrick skit.
Yeah, it was horrible.
What was that all about?
I don't know.
Come on.
You know, you have tapped into something. I reread this column this morning, anticipating of talking to you. This column you wrote back in, I think it was 2006,
yeah.
Talking about these beer-chugging, self-involved loudmouths.
Overmothered.
Puffy-faced buffoons.
Overmothered politicians who give Irish Paul such a bad name by partaking in these kinds of cliches and stereotypes.
Well, you know, you have tapped into something that is sort of in my bones. You're an Irish Catholic. I'm an Irish Catholic. Before I came to Boston, I used to kind of like St. Patrick's Day. You know, I used to wear my green down in Fall River. Now, almost in protest, I don't wear it anymore because I'm embarrassed by the parade. I'm embarrassed by the breakfast. I'm embarrassed of this adulation of South Boston. Everybody's Tommy and Stevie and Mikey, you know, and you know, Sullivan's with the terrible cheeseburgers. It's like this is what gets associated with Boston around the country. I mean, you talked about this in your piece, Romney making fun of these politicians. You were talking about more, but I feel almost this isn't what I think of myself as an Irish American, and I have come to resent this whole endless adulation. I mean, John Wacko Hurley, we want him to be sort of a heroic figure in 2014. You know what I mean?
Bingo, Marjorie. I couldn't agree more. I purposely do not wear green on St. Patrick's Day. I wore a green tie yesterday, the day after St. Patrick's Day. Jim, a tie is something you put around your neck and tie in a knot.
No, but I've heard about
it. I won't do it for that exact reason, Marjorie. Just like you laid out, and it's too bad. They don't celebrate St. Patrick's Day in Ireland the way we do here. They don't, partake in the ridiculous beer guzzling and all that, and fall into cliche. It is too bad. And look, at this year's breakfast was different because of who led it. This year's breakfast,
right.
I agree with the Globe writers. It did have added spark to it. It did have added interest to it because of who led it. But the humor was every bit as bad as it's been ever since Bill Bulger left as the moderator.
Yeah, he was painful. You know, my colleague at the Herald, John Stranich, a million years ago wrote a piece in Boston Magazine, and he said, why is it that every successful Irishman in Boston was born in a cold water triple decker and his mother was a washerwoman?
Yep.
You know, I know Ray Flynn's mother was a washerwoman, but she didn't end her life that way. You know what I mean? She became the mother of the mayor and had a distinguished senior citizen year. I don't get why that is, Brian.
We have this thing here, and I don't actually on that one, Marjorie, I don't think it's just the Irish. I think it's a Boston thing. Boston does it. Chicago does it, where we try to outdo each other with the awful childhoods we have and the rising up. I'll do it too. I grew up in a two-decker in Roslindale.
It was horrible. You walk 7 miles to school.
Getting sent to Boschetto's Bakery with $2 to buy cupcakes for dessert once every couple of weeks. But we all do that. I don't know what it is, but I don't think that part is just an Irish thing, but
Okay, well, let's move on.
By the way, let me just say, if you're going to do that, I grew up in a high rise and was number one in my bar mitzvah class. So let's just move on. Now you can move on, Marjorie.
Okay. Well, you had a unbelievably great story, an upsetting story, obviously, because everyone has such warm feelings for – he did write it – for Tom Menino, who, of course, has been diagnosed with metastasized cancer now and is in serious health trouble. Brian McGrory, how did this happen? Did Tom Menino call you up?
Well, first, to be clear, I co-wrote it with our great city hall reporter,
Andrew Ryan. Right.
It's terrific and, played – every bit as big a role in that as I did, if not more. I heard from Menino's people that week that he wanted to get together and chat about his health. So we arranged a time for late Friday afternoon, and we got together, and it was a pretty poignant discussion. And, I don't mind saying really, really sad at the same time.
But you said you did write about his demeanor and his not. I mean, one of the things that stuck with me is I don't want anybody to feel sorry for me. I'm moving on. I'm showing up at work tomorrow. All that was his thing. And you contrasted that with his very honest emotion about how difficult it was to leave office that he exhibited all over the place.
Yeah, he is. Look, he is being he's really determined about this. He's I don't think he's kidding himself. We had a long chat with his doctors, Andrew and I, and I don't think the mayor is kidding himself, but he is taking this, he is facing this head on. He is going to do what he needs to do. He's got three more rounds of chemotherapy left to go in this regimen. He wants to see where he is when these three rounds are done. They're going to be done every 2 weeks, so it's six more weeks. And he's playing it by ear. He is not feeling sorry for himself. He doesn't want anyone else feeling sorry for him. He's really resolute. He's in good spirits. He was showing me how his grandkids taught him this game, Candy Crush. He was showing me how he learned to use an Apple computer. And look, we had a really good conversation. When I say sad, maybe it was on my part that I was projecting. But you never want to go in as a reporter and talk to somebody about a diagnosis of incurable cancer.
Well, especially when that guy is not only prominent, but has worked 24/7 for decades, and all of a sudden has a little bit of a break in his life to, you know, smell the proverbial roses.
A couple of months in retirement. Yep.
Yeah. It's a little, you know, staying on this just for a second, Sunday morning, I don't know if you're aware, I was the host of the television coverage of the breakfast.
Spectacular.
There was a lot of discussion, not just real people, but people in the media, about the timing of the thing. Did Tom and Eno want it to come out on the day of the breakfast? Did you want it to come out on the day of the breakfast? Was there any consideration about the timing, considering that virtually every political leader, statewide, citywide, et cetera, was all in that one room?
I can't imagine a more self-involved way to look at it is the timing was meant to affect or not to affect this breakfast. It never occurred to me. And I'm sure it didn't occur to Tom Menino, and I hate to burst your bubble, Jim, but I don't think most people in this great state of ours wake up that Sunday saying, this is breakfast day. This affects what we do.
By the way, I wasn't suggesting that the average person on the street was thinking that at all, but I'm saying in the political and media world.
People at the breakfast, yeah. I'm sure there was, because they are, as you pointed out in your column, some of them are anyway, are a little bit self-involved.
No. I'm sorry. I don't mean to get perturbed about your question.
Fine.
But no, this nobody thought about. I don't know how else to put it. Nobody thought about the St. Patrick's Day breakfast when we decided to break the news of Tom Menino's cancer.
Now, did you read Shirley Leung's column this morning?
I did. It was terrific.
Okay, now here's a question that I thought we should be posed. She writes, one of the biggest challenges white men face in leading on diversity is they feel excluded. Do you feel excluded, Brian? Why are you laughing?
Why do I do this week in a week?
Why are you laughing? I don't get it. But one of the honorees, this is all about Colette Phillips,
yes.
Actually, who was at the breakfast talking
Colette
about this.
Colette is terrific.
She's
fabulous. Colette is a treasure in this town.
I could not agree more. And by the way, she was like, wind her up. And this woman, and she was talking about at the breakfast, we were talking before we went on the air about honoring these 12 white leaders, one of whom is obvious, and Colette Phillips is black, for those who don't know, and one of them, who's your boss, John Henry. Do you buy her theory, this quote I read? You buy that thing?
I do. I mean, I think she makes a very good point. Colette is really smart about diversity issues, and, you know, she understands it takes all types to weigh in on it. It's not an us-against-them thing. It's inclusion is truly about inclusion, and you've got to involve white men in how to resolve the issues of more diverse workplaces. So, the day as a columnist, I got to know Colette really well, and the day I took this job, she had me over to some events in Roxbury. She had me over to some events in Kendall Square. She is about bringing a lot of people from different backgrounds and different points of view together, and she does it really intelligently.
Remember, she was dating that famous actor.
What's his name? Who was the actor?
Well, I'm not telling tales out of school. Everybody knew about it.
No, she's public about it.
Everybody but me. Who are you talking about?
He was in. Wasn't he in?
Oh, let's not do this.
Okay.
If we get the wrong
we're going to be like that entertainment
reporter.
She was dating a very
prominent actor
in Boston or in.
No, he's a big national thing.
We goofed it up. I shouldn't have brought it up.
You shouldn't have brought it up. Edit the tape. Now, Brian, I have one last thing for you. Your lead story today is a new look at a classic. Gardner First Museum in New England New England to offer virtual walkthrough. Now, I know you're in your new digital phase. I know you personally are getting schooled. Are you not? Is that true?
What do you mean?
Is there? I mean, you're becoming more digitally competent. You tell us that almost every week. Is that correct?
I don't think we need to use the word become.
Okay, well, fine.
He's working
on
his Netflix account when last we spoke about this.
I am getting a Twitter machine installed on my desk. And, I'm going to start doing that.
Fine. So what we want to know, based upon the level of sophistication of Marcy Bullard, is there any way to calculate how many art thieves subscribe to the newspaper today to be able to follow Sebastian Smith?
What are you saying? That was a really good story.
It is a great story.
Yeah. Sebastian Smee won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yes, he did. He's a beautiful writer.
He is probably the single smartest, most accessible arts critic in the country. The city, this newspaper, is very, very fortunate to have him, and his take on this whole Google program, bringing the Gardner Museum to people sitting at their desktops, laptops, iPads, is a brilliant take.
I agree.
He's got a great byline, too. I think he rivals Billy Baker. That's another great byline. You know, Sebastian Smee and Billy Baker.
We hired Sebastian from a place in Australia, and it was a very ambitious move by him, a very ambitious play by the Globe, but boy, has that paid off. He is terrific.
Brian McGrory, it's a pleasure. You come back next week, or is this enough for you?
I don't know, Jim. I don't know.
Well, I tell you,
maybe you and I ought to have a talk. I don't know.
I think many years ago captured my obsession, which is the whole Irish thing in Boston, Brian. And I'm glad we're kindred spirits on that one. Anyway, thank you for being with us.
Good to talk to you, Brian.
Thank you, Marjorie. Thank you, Jim. Take care.
Brian McGrory is the editor of the Boston Globe. He joins us every Wednesday. I hope. We do hope, because we love talking to Brian. And by the way, the guy that Colin Phillips was dating.
Oh, you figured it out?
Lou Gossett Jr. He played the drill sergeant in Officer and a Gentleman, one of the great chick flicks, if I may use that phrase, of all time. Anyway, up next, we check in with bioethicist Art Kaplan for an explainer on former Mayor Tom Menino's cancer diagnosis and about the public's need to know about the health lives of elected officials. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
If we're going to really be serious about having students read more difficult things, we have to slow down.
On Campus is WGBH's Higher Ed Desk. What's going on with America's higher education system?
David Coleman is the so-called architect of Common Core. In his presentations to teachers across the country, he has strongly defended the new standard.
Listen for reports from Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Innuendo in Natick, celebrating the Hunter Douglas Energy Smart Style Window Fashions event, featuring Hunter Douglas Duet Arcatella Energy Efficient Shades, along with Silhouette and Luminette shading systems. Innuendo.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A former public official, Tom Menino, has an advanced form of cancer, which got us to thinking, what obligations do current and wannabe public officials have to publicly disclose their health conditions under such circumstances? Who are you going to call? Art Kaplan. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art, how are you?
Very good.
Good morning, Art. All. Thank you for joining us. So, Art, as Jim just said, the former mayor of Boston, Tom Menino, has been diagnosed with this advanced cancer that has spread to his liver and his lymph nodes. And apparently this is a very rare situation where something is called a cancer of unknown primary that they don't know where it came from. So what is the deal on this so-called cancer of unknown primary?
About 2% of cancers you can't track back to the a site where there is an original obvious tumor. So it's spread around his body, and I sadly have to say it's very dire, but you don't know where it started. And why does it matter? Because when you don't know where it started, it's harder to know what type of cancer it is. It's harder to know what type of treatment to use against it. So tumors are a little different if they're in the lungs or if they start off in the intestinal tract. When you don't know, it makes it all the harder.
You know, I read in the, when I was preparing for you today that you could have like prostate cancer that starts in the prostate and winds up someplace else in your body, but it's still prostate cancer.
Right.
That seems so strange.
Well, it's basically the kind of cell that forms in the prostate gets in the bloodstream and flies all over the place to your brain or your lungs or your liver, but it's still the type that formed in the prostate. So we call it prostate cancer, but all we're saying is originated there, and it's that kind of tumor that's now all over the place. But, it's not like a little bit of your prostate has gone to your lung.
Right.
It's just that kind of tumor started there.
But the reason I ask that, you hear, I mean, obviously nobody wants to get a cancer diagnosis. It's always very upsetting. But you hear that certain kinds of cancer, like prostate or maybe bladder, are a little bit more treatable. So, but is that true if the prostate cancer goes someplace else?
No, the more it spreads, or as they say, metastasizes,
okay,
the worse it is.
Okay.
So it's better to know what it is. We know that some tumors you can attack if they're bladder, in the bladder, and some you can attack in the intestinal tract if they haven't broken out, which, by the way, is why we all want to be getting colonoscopies to detect those early. But once they start jumping around the body, then things get dire.
Hey, Art, a couple Menino-related questions. Primarily, we want to talk about the obligation of public officials, which he is not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But staying just on him, Tom Menino has been pretty doctored up, for lack of a better expression, the last couple of years, a whole host of conditions. The Globe reported the other day that he didn't even know about this. No discomfort, no pain until he had a visit with his doctor. I think it was in February or something.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, when something is as advanced as this purportedly is it credible to believe that if you are in and out of rehab and doctor's offices, that something could escape their view for so long and then all of a sudden be as advanced as this thing apparently is?
I'm laughing because you said rehab. I was thinking Rob Ford, the Toronto guy. So that, however, does make the point that you could be in for drug treatment. You could be in for a venereal sexually transmitted disease. There are all kinds of things your opponents and your critics would love to know about you. I think if you have a disease that impairs your ability to function, it's up to the patient, and in this case, the politician, to say something. If you can't do your job, the people who elected you deserve your efforts. They deserve to know what's going on. If you said to me, you mean every town selectman, every dog catcher? Well, no, it's probably something that is more in the executive kind of a role. But if the president, say Ronald Reagan, is suffering from Alzheimer's, I think the nation needs to know that. If the president is suffering from psoriasis, you know, he's got itchy skin, I don't think the nation needs to know. It's not going to be impairing his office. But not up to doctors, up to the patient.
You know, and obviously, and let me just clarify what I said a minute ago. Even if Tom Menino knew earlier, it was at the end of his term, and I don't think there's any obligation there. But let's talk not just about current public officials, and I totally agree with you, even though I guess there's no formal standard for them. It's all personal discretion in terms of disclosure. The example that strikes closest to home is Paul Tsongas, obviously a local guy, ran for president in 1992. In 1991, he said he was cured of cancer he had had earlier, and the standard he was using, you know, 5 years of being clean. And then later, both the Globe and the New York Times reported that, in fact, in 1987, 4 years earlier, he had had some small node or something that might have been cancerous. And the Times in particular suggested he had been less than candid. Candidates for executive offices, particularly for that office, what's the conventional thinking in your world and in the medical world in general about what obligation they have to voters, to potential constituents?
No different from the anybody who's got a relationship with a doctor, no different with anybody who's in the hospital. We try hard to protect their privacy. Physicians believe that you're not going to get them to come in, especially if they're celebrities or politicians. They won't get the early signs of something treated because they're worried it's going to be leaked out. So the presumption is the patient drives the disclosure. The doctor's duty is for privacy. That said, Jim, you know, if you're really a prominent politician and you're in the hospital, I would say 50 to 100 people are likely to treat you in the course of ordinary care, meaning if you have a cancer, you have some sort of disabling stroke, a lot of people are going to see you and know. Is it likely to stay in there long term? I don't think so. I think it's going to leak out. So my general impression is we ought to say for the president, vice president, maybe Congress, there is a standard, and if something is out there that impairs your ability to function, you ought to disclose it.
We're talking with medical ethicist Art Langone. You know,
Art Kaplan,
from the Langone Medical.
If I can inherit some of that money, I'm right there.
I was so,
by the way, she is
Art Langone immediately.
She is Marjorie WGBH to you.
I was so excited to get to my next question, Art Kaplan, not Art Langone. I skipped over the Art Kaplan part, but I do remember, speaking of local guys, Chip O'Neill, who was the Speaker of the House, local congressman, came from Cambridge.
Yeah.
He had colon cancer, and he announced it. He wasn't making it a secret. But I thought, I'm so glad I'm not Chip O'Neill. Because I remember in the front page of all the newspapers were all these diagrams of colons and what they were going to have to do. And you thought, the poor guy. I mean, it wasn't Chip O'Neill's colon, but you kind of got the blow-by-blow, as it were.
So, Marjorie, I'm gonna make you feel a little better, because when that happens, it is educational. When the celebrities, you know, prostate cancer or the breast cancer in the female politician, you do learn about it. It is in the case. I know they didn't volunteer to be the example to the nation, but it's still, I'm going to defend it, or at least say, you know, maybe they feel a little bit better because they can help others. I remember Rudy Giuliani did that when he had prostate
cancer.
That's right. Urging testing, and that's great. I think that works out well.
Didn't LBJ, I mean, this is not a fatal thing, didn't LBJ have some surgery in and around his stomach?
He showed it. But in the classic case,
I think that was right after he pulled the beagle's ears, but yeah.
I think you're right.
That's right. Angelina Jolie was a classic case, talking about the preemptive mastectomies to deal with her breast cancer. So we move on.
I want to stay on this for just one more second, if we can, Art. So assuming that you were the czar of these things, I'd feel comfortable. But there are no standards, are they? I mean, the AMA hasn't put anything out. The universe of medical ethicists, it's sort of like the conventional thing.
I'll tell you, Jim, what we need is for us to put it out, not ethicists or doctors or hospital officials. You and I have to go to the voting booth and say, you know what, you want to run for president, we want an independent exam done of you with results published. You want to run for Senate, same deal. If we don't do that, the ethic of medicine is to keep it private, and it's not going to change.
So wait a second. So actually, you're thinking farther. So even if you purport to have a clean bill of health, you're suggesting you should have to disclose that so we can decide for ourselves.
Yeah, and I think it shouldn't just be your doctors who examine you, your old buddies and friends.
Yeah.
You might have an independent physical. I mean, it's the kind of thing you do for an astronaut or someone who wants to have a executive job. Sometimes the company says, you will get a physical and we will see the report on this. And something like that, we, the people, could ask of our politicians. I don't think it's asking too much. I favor it, but it hasn't happened.
You know, just one last thing, Art Kaplan, before we do move on here. I just want to be clear on this. Jim mentioned before about how the former mayor, Tom Menino, had been seeing so many doctors, and then apparently this metastasized cancer went undetected. How rare is that? I mean, you hear about it with ovarian cancer. That's what I think of. That with women,
the silent killer.
That's right. You don't know you have the disease until you're in pretty serious trouble. But is this not unusual either?
It's very, very rare that they can't track it back. Is it rare that people get things attacking them, cancers that they're not aware of for a little bit? No, sadly, you know, a lot of people don't go to get that colonoscopy, which visualizes the inside of their intestine and the thing is growing there and it doesn't do anything. They don't always bleed. So you can have a lot of silent killers out there. That's the argument for, if not the annual checkup, then at least the once in a while checkup to screen for things.
Art Kaplan, we will move on. Surgeon General nominee, a young guy from Harvard, apparently is not going to make it and may not even get a vote in the Senate for confirmation. Not because, I don't think, most people are suggesting he's not qualified to be Surgeon General, but because he thinks that guns are a public health issue. Where is your community on this guy?
So, absolutely, guns are a public health issue. You know, you don't get on the one hand, on the other, on this one, at least not for me. He's right. By the way, he's one of yours. He's a Harvard doctor, Murthy. So why? Why would you say that? Well, one of the biggest problems we have with guns is accidental shootings, and people with kids in the house don't lock up their ammo, and they don't practice safe gun handling, and they don't tell the kid what to do if they see a gun. And that's what we call a public health thing. You got to get the school nurse to talk about it. You got to get the pediatrician to ask the dad, mom, hey, if you have guns in the house, are you locking them up? Do you keep the ammo not where the gun is? Do you tell your child what to do if it's a little kid, 3, 4, 5, and they see one? Because, you know, we read, how often do we hear that some poor little kid picked up the gun and shot himself, shot a sibling? That's public health. And as long as I'm ranting about this, let me add one other one, because it comes from New Hampshire, just as an example. It turns out people commit suicide, do so within 3 days after buying a gun in a gun store. It's like demonstrated by studies. So gun owners up in New Hampshire have been involved in a program to try and detect suicidal behavior, agitation, and so on when someone comes in to buy a gun, and to know where they should send them, like to the hotline and what the number is, and give them a card and say, call here. That's public health. Gun dealers seem happy to do that, and range owners are doing it too. Those are people, I think, kind of like guns. So yeah, well, you know, the NRA is saying this guy can't be Surgeon General. He's playing politics. I think they're playing politics.
Well, Art Kaplan, I don't know what kind of physician you'd have to be nominated as a Surgeon General who wouldn't support putting some limit. I mean, what kind of physician? I would be suspicious of a physician who weren't concerned about guns as a public health hazard. So how do you get anybody?
I have a description for that physician. Bad physician.
Yeah.
Crummy physician. You know, what are you talking about? I mean, this whole thing is ludicrous. Not that I have strong feelings about it, but, you know, things are around in the environment that are dangerous. You want to tell people not to operate vehicles when you're under the influence of your medicine, right?
Yeah.
You might want to say, hey, we're not pro or anti-gun, or, you know, it's legal, you can have them, but here's how to handle them safely. Here's how to protect against accidents, and here's how to manage suicide. I think suicide is now ahead of car accidents as a cause of death in the U.S.
And by the way, before we leave this, we discussed this, the nomination of the Surgeon General, with CNN's John King yesterday. And for those who are saying, oh, it's just those horrible Republicans who are holding this up, John made it clear this is a bipartisan issue, that there are a lot of Democrats who are in states who are in tough re-election battles who don't want the vote to happen either.
Let
so it is a bipartisan embarrassment, not just the
Republicans. Let me see if I can make my chicken noise here. I mean, they are chicken.
Yeah.
Beautifully
running
put.
Well, on all sides of the aisle, and it doesn't. It's not right because they're not protecting our kids. They're not protecting our veterans who are at high suicide rate. They're just, on this one, they are just not doing the right thing.
Yet another argument for term limits. If they were not worried about the reelection, they might vote the right way. But anyway, let us move on to this story that is just so upsetting that you know a lot about. This 7-year-old that's been sick since infancy, he's being treated now at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. But there's this drug that could help this child. And typically, apparently, these drugs are administered to people who are dying under this compassionate use deal. But this child may not get this drug. What's the story here, Art Kaplan?
Well, not to spoil suspense, this kid, Josh Hardy, did get his drug. He just got it.
Great.
And so the campaign to get him the drug worked out. But going backwards, he had kidney cancer, and they gave him chemotherapy. But when you do that, you often make the person so sick that their immune system is destroyed. You kind of kill the cancer and kill everything else. So they had to give him a bone marrow transplant, and that's standard for treating that kind of pediatric kidney cancer. Anyway, some viruses live inside our body all the time, and when you have no immunity, they go nutty sometimes, and that's what happened to him. He had what's called an adenovirus. It just took off, infected his liver, and started to kill him. It was eating his liver. So there's no drugs that we know that will solve this problem. His parents were told by the doctors at St. Jude's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, we think there's a new drug being developed. It's just in research, but it might help this because it's an antiviral, and maybe it would help. They didn't know. So the parents call the company and say, would you give us the drug? And the company says, no. And that became a kind of classic mean, bad company refuses drug to little dying boy. Why? What's going on? Well, the company is saying, hey, we can't give you the drug because first, if we do, we don't have very much of it, and there may be other Joshes right behind your son, and we will not have enough. How do we say yes to him and no to others? Second, we're actually not a big, bad drug company. We're a little 50-person drug company with no budget. And if we give you this drug, we're never going to finish our trial to get it approved, and that would benefit the most Joshes down the road. So their argument was, well, no one's going to sign up for our trials if we give it away freely under this compassionate use idea.
Wow.
And by the way, the compassionate use idea generally is that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that even if a drug hasn't been approved, the exception is if someone is near death and it could change that circumstance, then the compassionate use thing may kick in. Is that correct?
That's right. And I've had requests personally, talk to the FDA, talk to families. Somebody's got a brain tumor. They're dying. We're doing some research in mice, which maybe 1 in 100 times turns into something useful in people. And they go online and they see it and they say, I want that. Could you get me that drug? So it can be really early in the drug development process that people beg to get access to something.
You know, when I was first hearing this story, my attitude was, I assume the attitude that virtually everybody would have, that, you know, how horrible can this drug company be? Mm-hmm. It could save this kid's life. But then when I read more, there is another side to the story. When it is not, you know, a huge drug company with unlimited resources, and it has to divert some of its very limited resources and person power to saving a little boy. I don't want to sound cruel,
and Jim,
but they make a point. I mean,
what's the other thing?
The other angle is, if the child dies after getting the drug, which sadly, because these people are very sick, is likely, no matter what we try, we rarely rescue anybody this way, it's held against the drug. And what I mean is, the drug company then now has to say, did our drug kill him or did the disease kill him? And obviously, it's usually the disease, but it can take him a couple of weeks, maybe months, to prove it. If you're running a little company and you don't have much budget and you get set back a month or 2 months, it sounds like, what's that? That could be the difference between bankruptcy and pushing forward to finish your trial. So in the background, the investors are all saying, no, Josh, keep going on. We don't want to see our money go down the drain. And that's the pressure. It's sort of, we need to get this approved. That's going to be the best thing for our company and the best thing for all the Joshes yet to come, versus if we stop now and do this, boy, that could set us back. It's dangerous.
So the reason this child and his family prevailed, this little 7-year-old Josh, was they went to a social media campaign and the newspapers?
Correct. So this is, you'll like this, Marjorie, this is new. Used to be you try to call up WGBH and say, my kid is sick, would you please do a story about him? But now what's happening is people go right to the internet, build up a Facebook, Twitter, other social media site, get hundreds of thousands of people to say, save Josh or save me, or I don't know, maybe it's even possible that somebody would care to save Jim, but, you know, somebody. And then they then point to the media and say, I have 100,000 people here. That's your story. So they're getting ahead of the old media or the traditional media, using the social media to make sure they get heard. And I think that's very interesting because we're going to see more of that.
Last thing for you today. You have to settle a dispute that we started yesterday. In 2007, Clemson University declared that the whole notion that there was a 5-second rule when you drop something like a piece of bologna on the floor was, as the doctor there, I think his name was Dawson, said, bologna. And then we discovered there was a recent study out of a university in the UK in Birmingham over there saying, wet food up to 5 inches is 5 seconds is fine. Dry food, like a cookie, up to 30 seconds is fine. Can you settle the dispute, Art Kaplan?
Yes, I can. Who's spending money for these studies?
The bologna companies.
The floor wax company. So we're in the midst of abundance in the U.S. You have an obesity epidemic. Leave it there. Go get another cookie.
Oh,
wow.
I wish I'd thought of that. That's right.
Hey, Art Kaplan, great to talk to you as always. Take
care. My pleasure.
Thank you, Art Kaplan, not Art Langone. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Thanks again, Art. Up next, we continue our conversation about health with a look at today's number 2 killer. It's the subject of a new Frontline documentary. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is Greg Wong.
Stay up to date with the latest in high-tech news, personalities, companies, and trends with the Xconomy Report, presented in partnership with Xconomy.com. Friday mornings at 7:50 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Innovation requires people clustering. This is the basic mechanism of economic growth.
I'm Kara Miller. The places where innovation grows. This week on Innovation Hub, Thursday night at 9 here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you and the Museum of Science, where you can step inside the Hall of Human Life and exhibit you and discover how everyday human behavior affects our brains, our bodies, and the world around us. Details at mos.org/exhibit you. And Doc Martin. Martin Clune stars as a brilliant physician whose blundering social skills and grumpy demeanor make for awkward interactions in a small town. Don't miss Doc Martin, tonight at 9 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Tuberculosis used to be considered a disease that belonged in the past. It was a recurring villain in just about every 19th century novel. It famously killed Fantine in Victor Hugo's Les Miserables. But even in the 21st century, it remains a deadly disease. There are new virulent, drug-resistant strains of TB emerging faster than ever, especially in certain parts of the world. It's a disease that can be passed by coughing, sneezing, and it's the second leading cause of death from an infectious disease. This is the subject of a new Frontline documentary. It's titled TB Silent Killer.
TB is an airborne disease. Mom died, Dad died, my sister died, I'm near. So to me, I feel like I'm alone in this world.
We've got to effectively control TB if we want to make ourselves safe. Because the truth is, anyone can get TB. Anyone can die from TB. And it's a killer.
The film premieres on March 25th. Here with us in Studio 3 is the filmmaker behind this terrifically powerful work, Jezza Newman. Jezza, good to see you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for coming in, Jezza. And it was incredibly powerful and very upsetting, and I was embarrassed to say I knew almost nothing about this until I saw your Frontline documentary. So tell people where you went and what you found.
So I traveled to a country in southern Africa called Swaziland. Swaziland is got the highest rate per capita of drug-resistant TB in the world. And it was a place where Doctors Without Borders, Medicine Sans Frontières, had been called in by the government to help them with this epidemic. And they had declared it a national disaster. MSF felt that there was not enough noise being made around TB. It was a disease of the past that it was a disease of the past for media as well. So they were keen to get this highlighted. And the Swazi government were incredibly open, and I felt very brave to open up their country to us and their Ministry of Health and allow us in to film with their doctors and their nurses and see for myself what's this all about.
Doctors, nurses, and those suffering from this disease, I have to say, some of these stories and some of these people, can you just briefly shine a little bit of a light, and then people should watch this on the 25th, on the 17-year-old boy, his younger sister, and both of whom lost their mother. Tell the story of that family.
Yeah, Nokbega is one of those beacons of light in life that, just really captures you. She had literally lost her mother 2 weeks before we arrived.
She 12
there.
Or 10, I can't remember. 12?
She's 12.
12,
yes.
Maybe. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And she had lost her mother had passed away 2 weeks before we got there. And it was already a very raw time for her. And, she ultimately is diagnosed with drug-resistant tuberculosis and has to go away into isolation because there's no one to care for her. But I think the thing to remember here is that Nokbega is a beautiful little girl who loves pink. She loves to dance. she flower arranges. You know, this is a kid that could be the kid next door. You know, this is a kid. What I like to think is if you can give this film a chance and just give it its first few minutes, then you'll get hooked in and realize that Swaziland isn't so far away, not on the human terms.
You know, the juxtaposition, I'm so glad you mentioned those two scenes that I frankly will never forget. On one hand, you see this little kid dancing along with a video on her television
screen.
Yeah, in
her little
and
pink
you say,
outfit.
It's just, you know, it could be my kid doing that same thing. And then you see her, the scene where she and her 17-year-old brother, who essentially is now her protector, are sitting on the steps of their house when the medical person comes to say the bad news is you have drug-resistant TB and you've got to go away for a couple of years. And the brother immediately, as the protector, says, is she going to be able to have schooling? Is she going to get... It is so unbelievably powerful. And she's just sitting there, this incredibly smart kid. I mean, so smart, so well-spoken, taking in this news as a tear runs down her cheek. It takes your breath away.
We're talking with Jessa Newman, who just did this Frontline documentary titled TB, The Silent Killer. You know, I was curious, just as a reporter, how you got that scene Jim just mentioned of the nurse, I believe she was, that came to inform this little girl that she was had this particularly virulent strain of this TB that isn't just the, not that the first regular TB is quick, but this is a year and a half to 2 years of very heavy duty inoculations and pills and so forth. How'd you get that? You knew that she was coming. How'd you do that? I'm dying to know.
So that comes down to the relationships you build on the ground and spending time there, and you don't just sort of go in. You know, luckily, unlike news, I'm afforded time. You know, as a documentary filmmaker, you have more time on your hands. So we spent time sort of garnishing relationships with the healthcare workers. So
Okay. We
had spoken to the Baylor Clinic, and there's a wonderful Spanish doctor there who really, you know, was behind what we were trying to achieve and do. And so basically when she knew that, we said to you, if you have any kids that have been tested, but you haven't given the test results to yet.
Okay.
And so we knew the nurse was coming. We didn't know what the outcome was going to be at that point, because obviously patient confidentiality, but we knew that she was coming to deliver the news. And we had met the brother and Notbega earlier, so we had obviously knew that they were open to us filming this news.
Okay. And tell people a little bit about Swaziland, too, because the pictures of it were, on the one hand, beautiful. I mean, it's a gorgeous country. On the other hand, it looked like there was tremendous poverty there, too.
Yeah, I mean, Swaziland is another, you know, African country that is struggling at the moment, like many countries around the world.
Border of South Africa, is that where it is?
Yeah, it's landlocked. So it's got South Africa around three of its borders, if you like, and then Mozambique on the other. Mm-hmm. And it's the last, it's actually a kingdom of Swaziland. So it's actually one of the last countries in the world to be controlled by a king. And it is stunningly beautiful. It has absolute beauty. It has wildlife there. Its tourism is one of its major industries. But traditionally it's been a farming culture. And so a lot of, although with the way the world has changed, people have moved into business, it has direct links with South Africa, a lot of people still do survive on a basic farming system.
You know, you mentioned the bravery of the government allowing you to do this, particularly, and the people who allowed you to interview them, particularly since you make clear how stigmatized people are who have TB. Two related things. One, why did these people decide, despite the stigma, that they'd be willing to talk to you? And two, how did you all stay safe? I mean, we learn there's supposed to be X minutes of exposure and then get out of there. You couldn't possibly have filmed some of the things you filmed in 15 minutes. I mean, it's not doable. So dress both if you can, Jonah.
Yeah, I mean, on the level of the contributors who took part, it's you know, that is one of the toughest parts when you start making a film, because, you know, you've said, oh, yeah, great, we're going to make this film about TB. And then you get down on the ground and you've got to actually find the people who are prepared to talk to you. And like you say, there are huge stigmas. So
why?
Many people...
Why?
Why are there stigmas?
Why is it such a stigma?
It's stigmatized because people fear, because there's this whole, you know, there are, it's a complicated issue, but with it around TB. And so out of this, because there's no there's different ways you can catch it. There's different types. There's different, and so people just live in this fear. The one thing that everybody knows, it's an airborne disease. So you can catch it through a cough and a sneeze. So for many people, they fear that if you have TB, if you're anywhere near me, I'm going to catch it. So that people are completely stigmatized. Also, in the context of Swaziland, the majority of people who have TB are also HIV positive. Mm-hmm. So they kind of came hand in hand. So you had the stigmas surrounding HIV, which then sort of baton passed over to TB.
And when you say, by the way, that this is the, just on that note, that this is the second biggest infectious disease in the world, number one is HIV. Is that what it is?
No, for infectious disease, malaria.
Malaria is number one. I'm sorry. So, and how about you? How did you and your colleagues, how did you all stay safe?
So we stayed safe we had to wear the masks you're supposed to limit your time. It's about, you know, it's about distance, how close you are to people, and also time on the wards of the hospital. But as you say, you know, if you're in the middle of talking to somebody who's opening up their heart to you, right, you don't go, oh, well, I've been here 10 minutes, I'm leaving now, you know. So it's about risk taking. It's calculated risks. I've always done that. I've worked in, you know, undercover before. I've worked in Zimbabwe, China, Tibet. So, you know, I ride a motorbike. So, you know, pretty much my, you know, so I am a risk taker. However, you know, you do have to be sensible about this and you have to take calculated risks. But the trouble is, it is tricky because this is airborne and it's invisible.
So we're talking with Jezza Newman, whose Frontline documentary, TB Silent Killer, is going to be on March 25th. Tell us about this little girl that Jim mentioned at the beginning. She'd already lost her mother just 2 weeks before. She's there with her a brother, and she's facing, because she's got this drug-resistant form of tuberculosis, she's facing this long, arduous treatment. What did that entail?
The treatment entails basically 6 months of injections and up to 2 years. Well, 6 to 8 months of injections and 2 years of pills. What that amounts to is, if you follow the full course, you'll have, by the end of treatment, you'll have had 240 injections and taken 14,600 pills.
And she had to endure this. Her mother's gone. Her brother's living, I believe it was 2 hours away.
Mm-hmm.
So she's pretty much a 12-year-old girl by herself in the hospital. And I noticed there's no TVs or remote control in the hospital there. We're talking basically a bed.
Yes, it's very sparse. The beds have to be a certain feet apart, so it limits even how many people are there at any one time. So nobody wants to go there, because the rumours of Swaziland is, well, don't go near the National TB Hospital because the air is full of TB. So, you know, it's not like you've got, you know, a car park full of visiting relatives.
Yeah.
Nobody goes there. Everyone's terrified of it. So everyone stays away. So, yeah, she was very isolated. She's making best do as she can. I mean, and I think that's why you need to watch this, because she will... If nothing else from this film, you will take away a true testimony of human spirit and the way that she handles this, deals with this. I think that you'll maybe think twice when you're swearing because you're stuck in traffic, or, you know, you're late for work.
It's exactly
again.
What Marjorie said to me this morning. It's exactly.
As long as you brought that up, this is not the first tough film you've done. I mean, you've done a thing on child poverty for Frontline and child trafficking. So, and Undercover in Tibet. So, I mean, I bet you not. Maybe you do after you've been home for a while. But, you know, we sweat small stuff all the time. I have to wait in line for 5 minutes. I'm a nervous wreck. I don't want to, you know, I'm so impatient. My internet's not starting up. I mean, do you have a perspective on the world from seeing what you've seen? Or do you come back and become as impatient and obnoxious as the rest of us?
I'm a rugby player, so I'll probably get some of it out that way. But, no, I have had a better perspective. I have calmed down. I used to be a much more aggravated driver, I'd say. But, yeah, it does throw perspective on your life. And it does. I'm a father too. So I've seen, particularly now as my children have hit sort of 11, 13, you know, these are the ages. And prior to this, like with, you mentioned poor kids, those kids were, some of them were exactly the same ages as my children. So I can mirror and see what they're going through. And it's very interesting you say that, because actually there's a big issue at the moment in the UK, like in many places, there's not much land. So they're building building houses everywhere, and everybody goes, oh, don't build social housing on my street, you know. And so here I am on the one hand making films about social issues and saying people need to be given a voice, and then they're suddenly building this huge big tower block right down my street where I live, and I'm going, but don't, well, yeah, okay.
Hey, Jez, I have bad news. We're making a film about you next. Jez, you know, one of the, I assume everybody who watches this film of yours on the 25th is going to have the exact same reaction, which is, well, that's there. And as horrible and sad as this is, thank goodness it's not us. We've essentially eradicated tuberculosis. But then you hear this doctor at a TB hospital in Swaziland. Listen.
In developed countries, in Western countries, they should be threatened with the spread of TB. But there is no global response.
The fact is, we cannot choose the air you breathe. And hence, anyone can get TB. Anyone can die from TB.
We are living in the era of globalization. So infectious airborne diseases like TB is given a great opportunity to spread worldwide very rapidly and have a huge impact on global public health.
But it seems to me, Jezza Newman, that because most of us here believe, and in most of the Western world, this isn't going to happen to us, they're not going to get help. People in Swaziland and other developing nations that are having this onslaught aren't going to get help because essentially we share the sadness, but we don't think we're next. Is that not a fair characterization of the state of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's been very low on a drive to invest in new drugs because it's not affecting the Western world, so there's no money in it.
What has it been, you say roughly four decades since new drugs for this level of this drug-resistant thing have even been put on them?
Yeah, the last drug that's being used today was actually developed 39 years ago, if we're going to be precise. But the one, and the oldest one is 70 years ago. So no new drugs have been developed other than until recently. There were two drugs that were passed. However, we're talking about a cocktail of drugs. So it's not like you develop a new drug and then that's it. It's not like you take a Tylenol and your headache's gone. You know, this is, you've got to have six different types of Tylenol in six different measures to work out how you, and then you're just adjusting it all the time. So it's not about one or two drugs. It's about getting a combination of drugs that's going to reduce the length of treatment down. And I think the key to remember with this too, actually, if you look at the characters in the film, the thing that the characters of the film suffered from was not the disease of tuberculosis. It was the treatment, because it was the side effects. The side effects that for many adults will send them deaf, which cause vomiting, which can cause cause aching bones. So I think, and this is one of the bits that the film really draws out, is as well as the TB, as well as the treatment, it's then what happens to your life. It's the fact that your life, when it does come here and it's traveling, it's moving, there have been cases in the US, so it is documented to be here, MDR, and to drug-resistant tuberculosis is here. And you know, only time will tell how that grows, because you're already seeing, as you said, mentioned before, I made a documentary, Poor Kids in America, and I highlighted how levels of poverty were increasing, nutrition was falling, housing standards were falling. This is the breeding ground of TB. TB loves it if your immune system is down. That's where it thrives. So it's perfectly plausible and feasible that you will start to see much larger outbreaks of drug-resistant TB. And when that happens, your life falls apart around you because you've got to be isolated. You've got to be kept separate from the rest of society. And as you see in the case of Not Beggar, that means she loses out on an education. Now, even if she only loses that education for 6 months, that's already set her back 6 months behind her peers. So anyone that suffers it, their life has already been stepped backwards.
Jez, we both saw this
phenomenal.
Last night. It's terrific.
It's phenomenal, and you did fantastic work, and it's a really worthwhile documentary. Congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Jez Newman is the filmmaker behind the new Frontline documentary, TB, Silent Killer. It premieres next Tuesday night, but you can catch Jezza tonight here at WGBH. If you want to learn more about this event and to register to attend yourself, Go to Frontline's Facebook page at facebook.com/frontline. Thank you again for being here with us. Up next, we're going to come back to maybe a smaller problem to worry about compared to this, but it's still a problem. Whether sleep reform is the key to better grades for adolescents. Not so much education reform, sleep reform. It's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be.
I came to school not understanding the loans that I was taking on, and I'm realizing more and more how much debt I'm going to be in once I graduate college.
College delivers tough lessons about debt that millions of students learn too late. The high price of college's hard knocks. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru XV Crosstrek Hybrid with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com. And Newton Wellesley Hospital, presenting a health fair and community open house Sunday, March 23rd from 9 till noon in their new ambulatory care center, 159 Wells Ave in Newton. Info at nwh.org/community.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. To sleep or not to sleep? Is that the question that education boards across the nation should be answering? Could the key to doing better in school and in life be some serious sleep reform for teens? There's brand new research out that finds that teenagers who start their school day later do better, not just at learning, Marjorie, staying injury-free in sports, safer in driving, and that's simply because they get more sleep. So we want to know at 877-301-8970, where are you on this? Would reworking the school day to give teens more sleep be a good thing, or are the inconveniences for parents, for teachers, for student-athletes, for students with jobs outweigh any benefit? 877-301-8970. Arnie Duncan, Secretary of Education, tweeted in August of last year, "Common sense to improve student achievement that too few have implemented. Let teens sleep more, start school later."
Well, there was an article and it's that our crack research team got for us out of Eastham about Nauset High School.
This is great.
Where 2 months after they changed the time and started the day at 8:35, about an hour later than the year before, in 2 months, they had big improvements in academics. They had a huge drop in the number of days students were suspended from school. Tardiness declined by 30%. They had a 53% drop in the number of failing grades from 221 to 104 in the same period. So,
give the number of days students were suspended for disciplinary reasons, which you mentioned, dropped from 166 to 19.
Yeah, 166 to 19. That's right. So, I mean, I think this is absolutely true. My kids went to Brookline High School, which started at 8:30, and it was a much more civilized kind of deal because you could, if you live close to the school, you could get up at 8 o'clock and, you know, shove some food in your mouth and get in the car or jog if you were walking there and get to school by 8:30. It was much more reasonable. I can't imagine these poor kids having to start at 7:15 in the morning or 7:30 in the morning. Teenagers, and as the studies point out, their circadian rhythms, teenagers kind of built to stay up late and sleep late. As everybody knows, as teenagers, you know, on the weekends we're sleeping till, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon if they don't have something to do. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, BPR at WGBH.org. I think I got it right that time, is the email bpr@wgbh.org.
I'm glad you said what you said a minute ago, because a lot of people say, well, you know, just go to bed earlier. This is a biological thing.
Way.
This is not teenagers, right? Their rhythms are not made that way, and the melatonin doesn't kick in at the same time as everybody else. And also, let me make clear that all this research doesn't just say better grades and fewer disciplinary problems, as Marty was describing a minute ago. Fewer traffic accidents.
That's a good
less
point. Yep.
Illegal drug use.
Right.
Virtually everything that relates to their lifestyle and their school lives improves. Now, the flip side, just to get it on the table before we take calls at 877-301-8970. If the kid has a job in the afternoon, it's a problem. If the kid plays sports while he or she will be likely more injury-free, that's also a problem. Parents are upset about schedules, and I'm sure Marjorie will tell you in a few minutes, some teachers, including in Massachusetts, are not happy about the schedules and the inconvenience.
Yeah, why don't we just get that off the table right away, because Jim will defend them all. That they had this middle school up in Worcester, that was doing much, much better when they shifted the starting time from 7:15 to 8:37. But then they switched it back. And you know why they switched it back? Even though the kids were doing much better, eighth graders getting significantly higher grades. Well, Jim, the teachers didn't like it. So the heck with the kids. The teachers don't like it. Switch it back to 7:15 in the morning. 7:15 in the morning. Some of these kids have to get up at 5:30 in the morning. Remember when we used to get up at 3:30 in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning?
We were paid very well for that. That's
a little bit different. We were, and we're grown-ups. But you can imagine being a teenager getting up at 5:30 is terrible.
Also, you know, there are creative solutions to some of the problems. I don't know what district this was. I don't think it was in Massachusetts. But they were talking about the fact that there's almost no time to do homework because some kids would do it in the early afternoon rather than late at night. So one school district, you know what it did in response to that legitimate complaint?
What?
It put Wi-Fi on the school buses. So the kids essentially on the half hour or 45 minutes that they're riding the buses home could start doing their work. So the point is creative thinking about this can work, but the jury is in. The jury is in. The verdict is in. Sleep-deprived kids don't do as well in and out of school. And those kids who have an opportunity to sleep till a reasonable hour do better. It's not because they're lazy. It's because of their biological makeup. So is it something your district has experimented with or at least debated? And if not, is it something you'd like to see them deal with? 877-301-8970.
Jim in Hyde Park. What do you think, Jim?
Hey.
Right. Actually, great show. I couldn't agree more. I just visited a middle school the other week, and they were very proud of themselves that they started early. And I had to bring my son in for some testing. And, of course, he couldn't get there till a little late, and the tester was like, argh, argh. Like, you know, like you say, it's biological. It's not that they're all lazy bums, which they could be. But, it's not just how they perform in school. It's developing systems for life that if you're beating up your body, you know, at from the ages of 12, you know, to 17, it's like, what are you teaching the kids?
Right.
You know, you're teaching them to ignore their natural needs.
Well, you also want, I mean, you started us in an additional direction, which I think is an important one, Jim. You also, not only what are you teaching them, you want them to actually enjoy the learning thing. And if they're exhausted and strung out from whatever, the reality is that's not going to happen. So on virtually every, this is not one of these things, in my estimation, where there's one hand, and then on the other hand, there's some issues that have to be resolved. Again, particularly lower income families where the kid needs to work in the afternoon. Well, figure out a solution because ultimately the kid's going to be better off. Jim, thank you for the call.
Well, they also say in one of the stories, and I misplaced the exact time, I think they said that kids need between 8.5 and 9.5 hours of sleep every night, and they're not getting it. I mean, if you're going to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Mathematician, what time do you have to go to bed? Pretty early.
If you have to go to 5 o'clock in the morning, you have to go to bed 3 o'clock the prior afternoon. Now, the University of Minnesota, I have no idea.
Thank you.
At 9 o'clock. The University of Minnesota study tracked 9,000 high school students in 5 districts in Colorado, Wyoming, and Minnesota before and after school shifted times, this is the New York Times. In those that originally started at 7:30, only a third of students were able to get 8 or more hours sleep, which is the threshold. Students who got less than that reported significantly more symptoms of depression, greater use of caffeine, alcohol, illegal drugs, etc. In schools that now start at 8:35, which is an hour and 5 minutes later, nearly 60% of students reported getting 8 hours of sleep nightly. And the results across the board, with a couple of exceptions, but virtually across the board, are all positive, all improved.
Emily just emailed and said she thinks making children of any age go to school at 7:30 is inhumane. Children need sleep. They do. But I think little kids, it's a long time since mine were little, but they get up pretty early. You know, they're always getting up pretty early. When they get to be teenagers, that's when they can just sleep forever.
Well, you know what the other problem is? The resistance. This is one of these things where, remember, I can't remember his first name, and I feel bad about it, the former Commissioner of Education, Driscoll.
David Driscoll.
David Driscoll. He would come in our studio and talk about
Loved
how
him.
These school hours were formed in agrarian times in this country. You know, when people had kids had to help get up and help with the crops. That was in the context of a discussion of a longer school
summer
day.
Summer vacation.
But right, exactly. But and the summer vacation. The only reason this doesn't change, because the evidence is overwhelming, is because it is what it is. Kids are supposed to get up and be at school at 7:30 because that's how it's always been. But it isn't how it should be.
Well, the teachers have to go to their second job too.
Okay, fine, Marjorie. I know. We get back to the teachers. That was one aberrational situation in Worcester, and I suggest
just teasing you, Jim.
Let's go to Norwood.
Just teasing.
Lynn is on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, and we're talking about later start times for schools. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. So I'm so glad to hear this subject being raised, because I've been thinking about this for years. And like my daughter, when she was in grammar school, it started at 8:40, I think the bell rang. And of course, like you're saying, kids that age, they just pop up at 5 or 6 a.m. They're jumping all over the place.
Exactly.
And they're ready. And then in junior high, the shift was, oh my goodness, it was, her bus came at 7. And the first bell rang at 7:20, so suddenly it's almost an hour and a half earlier for her to adjust. And now she's a freshman in high school, and, you know, hormonally they're even more tired in the afternoon when they come home. And then she has practice, like sports practice, 3 hours twice a week at night. She is getting hurt. Her back hurts. She comes home, she's hungry. The whole thing is just such a mess, and I feel so powerless to control it. And I know that, you know, flipping that necessarily isn't the solution for everyone, but I feel like there's got to be a better way than the way it is now.
Well, by the way, so is she a freshman now, or are you telling us a history?
She's a freshman now.
So is there any move by parents like you or by students like your kids in front of your Norwood school board to at least take up this issue? Because, by the way, the New York Times story that is fabulous tells the story of I think, a sophomore who essentially leads the charge to change the hours, and ultimately her school board votes 6-1 in favor
and
of
the
later
evidence,
hours.
The evidence is pretty overwhelming.
Yeah, overwhelming.
I mean, you got that on your side if you pursue
so
it.
So is anybody doing anything, Lynn, or no?
Not that I know of, but now that I'm hearing so much about it and hearing what you just said, you know, when people start talking about it and there's movement, that's when people, you know, start listening and doing more. So, yeah.
Lynn, if you lead the charge, tell them Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education, is behind you. Lynn, thanks so much for the call.
Well, it's not hopeless. That's one of the great things about town government. You get 15 parents to go to the school committee meeting and say, this is ridiculous. And, you know, the school committee people, they all want to get reelected. You scare them into action. Exactly, Jim.
Let's go to Lorraine. You're in a car. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call, Lorraine.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, it's Maureen.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Maureen.
Our apologies.
This is one of my favorite subjects when my kids were in school. They graduated. My last one graduated in 2004. I was on the school committee for a couple of terms. These studies go back almost 20 years, and I brought it up first chance. Nobody was interested, couldn't get anywhere. My last child got a little bit of the benefit the last couple of years because I finally changed the hours. But I remember one night, both kids were good students. They did well, and they had tons of homework on top of sports, music, paper routes, if you remember paper routes, and so on. And I said to Joe, you should go to bed. It's midnight. Mom, don't you think I want to go to bed?
Yeah.
Well, that's just the way it was. And then that kid had to get up and be on the bus and be in school at 7:20.
Well, you know, that's a whole other topic that drove me crazy. I'm absolutely with you, Maureen. Too much homework. Practices are too long. I mean, it's just crazy. Kids getting home from practices at 6:30 at night, and they have games, and they get home at 8 o'clock at night, and they get 3 hours of homework. It's just insane.
We should have the homework debate on this show at some point.
Too much homework.
Thank you so much for the...
Too much homework.
For the call. So what do you think is the resistance? I gave you my two cents. It's sort of, this is the way things are. You don't take any chances.
I told you.
Why are they not doing it?
I told you.
Because the teachers don't want to
do
it.
Second job.
Holly, you're in Rhode Island.
They got a job at the mall, Jim, and they want to be there by 2.
You are in
so they can be home in time to cook dinner.
Holly, you're in Rhode Island, and now you're on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Holly.
Hi. Thank you for putting this topic on your show.
Thank you.
I was just calling to comment. This research has, you know, been around for a long time, and it's been presented at school boards in Rhode Island. And I think a big obstacle is that parents often rely on the big kids getting home before the little guys to help watch them until mom and dad get home from work. And so I think school committees and towns are going to have to be creative about that aspect of things, because it's a real logistical problem for a lot of families with working parents.
Yeah, that is, Holly, one of the things that's mentioned in the stories, that is what happens a lot of the times. But that's another thing that gets back to Jim's thing about David Driscoll, the former State Commissioner of Education in Agricultural Times. I mean, it almost seems criminal that we let kids out of school at 2 o'clock and you don't provide an after school thing that isn't, you know, $1,000 a month or something that's reasonable, that people can afford it. Because how many mothers are...
$1,000 a month? How, are you talking about for really young kids?
After school programs.
Really young kids. Why are parents paying anything? Why aren't there just longer school days?
Well, there should be longer school days. But what I'm saying is most schools get out 2:30.
I understand that.
And you're sending kids home. I mean, how many mothers are home now in the afternoon? I think it's the majority of mothers now are working when their kids are in school or when their kids are older. So you know what I mean, Holly? They should be keeping them in school longer.
I agree. But it's, you know, I think a lot of families struggle and they maybe can't afford. They're relying on those older kids to get home. And
yeah.
They can't afford these. A lot of after school care for young kids is very expensive.
That's a great point.
Well, you know, the charter school bill is probably
going
to die up at the State House today. It's the extension of the charter bill. They're voting on it to lift the cap on charter schools.
Well, they may not have a chance to vote. It's got to be reported out of committee.
I'm sorry. Yeah. You're absolutely right. You know what time charter schools stay open until?
I don't know.
5, 6.
Well, ultimately, that's the trend. What's the name of the organization that, who's the guy? This is horrible. Massachusetts 2020, is that the name of the organization? Yeah, that's the organization that's working for longer school days. And by the way, speaking of organizations, we should say for people who are interested in this let them sleep more thing, there's a national organization that's dealing with this too, which I will find for you in 1 second. They have a lot of great stuff on their website. It's called Start School Later. If you Google that, maybe just called startschoollater.org. But in any case, there is a movement that is happening everywhere. 20-some states are already doing this in some of their districts. Dave, you're in Cambridge. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, thanks.
So I think from my personal experience with my kids, they would just stay up later if they could sleep later. I believe that it's a greater organizational initiative that helps to reduce these problems like absenteeism and disciplinary problems.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Well, so I'll give you an anecdote from my own experience.
Sure.
When I went to boarding school in this area in the 80s, and we had a problem, a distinct problem with boarding. It was boarding and day. And there was a problem with boarding students getting to the first class on time. Absenteeism was something like double what it was for the day students who had to catch the subway or the bus or get rides to campus. And so the administration wanted to implement a lights out policy to enforce bedtimes for boarding students, and there was a huge hoopla. Nobody wanted that to happen. So the student body actually came up with the idea to implement a breakfast check-in, which required students to be at breakfast, which ended about 15 minutes before the first class began, and that solved the problem because nobody wanted to have disciplinary action.
But that's like saying by having an earlier school starting time, you know, kids in most cases will show up. The question is, what kind of condition were they in, both at the beginning of school and in your case, what kind of condition were they in at the breakfast?
Well, regrettably, I don't have any statistics to back it up.
I'm not suggesting it wouldn't cause a greater attendance. I'm just saying that data suggests that the kids are going to be totally wiped and do worse in a whole spectrum of ways. But, Dave, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Lauren says she always hears the problem is the after-school sports. Schools in different leagues have to have the later ending times in order to make games after school.
Well, they said in one of the articles, by the way, that for away games, some kids were needing to miss the last class. But none of these are insurmountable problems. Of course there are problems, and including the one that Holly just mentioned. They got to be addressed.
Listen, we have an email about Boston Latin Academy, which is one of the exam schools in Boston, that this person's child is now at a school that starts at 9:15. Boston Latin Academy starts at 7:20. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, by the way, I don't know if you're noticing the monitor in the studio. There's obviously a huge technological problem on CNN, D.C.,
oh my goodness!
They're discussing about Ukraine yeah.
Instead of about the airplane.
It's an abomination.
They've been talking about the Malaysia aircraft. All
in any case,
long.
The organization, I know you guys are interested. Start School Later is the name of it. Google it, check it out, and get involved.
My goodness, I didn't notice we were almost done.
We are. Almost
I was so
done.
Into the topic.
Like
we are done. I didn't realize that. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we have open mic with Alex Beam, who's always fun, and we'll also talk to the founder and CEO of Roka. This is a program about reducing recidivism among young men and keeping them out of jail. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team is Chelsea Mers, Will Roslip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for listening, and please listen again tomorrow.